song of sorts. Well, it is an animal song. Not really of sorts. It's instrumental, though, for sure. It eases us into today's edition of Talking Animals. My name's Duncan Strauss, here with our program that's devoted to all subjects in the animal kingdom. In just a few minutes, we'll be hearing today's guest, Jill Robinson, founder and executive director of Animals Asia Foundation, a Hong Kong-based organization with offices worldwide devoted to the welfare of wild and urban animals in Asia. We'll find out about all that involves. There's plenty and more when we hear from Jill Robinson in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also, a bit later in the show, we'll step into the Comedy Corner, which involves animal comedy. We'll play Name That Animal Tune. The winner will receive a copy of Tears and Other Stories, the latest 2-CD package by Richard X. Heyman, great singer-songwriter and past guest, noted cat rescuer in New York City, and more. So we'll also chat briefly with Sharon Dipple of Greyhound Support Transport, and find out about the organization's first picnic fundraiser taking place this Sunday in Largo. We'll also offer a chance for you to pledge for a pair of tickets to see Katie Lang October 7th at Ruth Eckert Hall. You can see an amazing show and support Talking Animals and WNF, all for the fabulous pledge of $80, which I believe is less than you would pay. You're just going to see the show itself. So right now, though, it's time for animal news and announcements. And today's edition, I think what we're going to do, after I make a quick further info about the pledge and our fund drive, we're just going to mostly, I think, run down announcements of different events coming up. And we'll just do them chronologically till we need to get into our conversation with Jill Robinson. So, first of all, as I alluded to a moment ago, we do have a pair of tickets to see Katie Lang. Great, great new album. Great sort of modified band that she's been touring with. Sounded terrific and great reviews. They'll be holding forth October 7th at Ruth Eckert Hall. And for an $80 pledge, we'll get you a pair of tickets. Again, that's less than you would pay if you were just buying tickets to see Katie Lang. And you can give us a jump start supporting Talking Animals and WNF for our forthcoming fund drive. So 813-239-9663. And go see Katie. Support us. Again, I'm going with the win-win cliche. Started using that cliche now. What's wrong with me? Anyway, and of course, this is all gearing up for our fund drive, which our fall fund drive is October 12th through 19th. So that starts 2 weeks from today, and Talking Animals indeed starts on the very first day, October 12th, 11 a.m. And really hope you'll be there to support Talking Animals with whatever kind of pledge you can make to let the program director and others here at the station know that they made a wise decision by expanding our time to an hour weekly, which it otherwise had not been for our previous years here at WMNF. So anyway, and we'll always, of course, have cool thank you gifts. Some are very exclusive. The week at the condo in Kauai comes quickly to mind, where you can see turtles and dolphins and whales just from the balcony of the place, much less getting out and amongst the folks, and this amazing whale watching package to see the friendly whales, kind of the singular phenomenon in the world, as far as we know, that takes place in Baja California, and signed copies of A Dog's Purpose, still on the New York Times bestseller. And author Bruce Cameron was a guest on the show the day the book came out and was kind enough to send some signed books with little Talking Animals-related inscriptions and more. So check in with us at talkinganimals@wmnf.org if you want to find out how to help us in advance. And again, you can go to our tip jar. You go to wmnf.org and find Talking Animals on the schedule, on the Wednesday schedule, obviously at 11 a.m. Click on that and go to the Talking Animals page. And in the right-hand corner, there's a tip jar. Slip in $25, $50, $100 if you can swing it. More if you can swing it. But just help us out so we have a running start 2 weeks from today when our fund drive starts. And there's other ways to help and join the Talking Animals team that day, or that week, really, to answer phones, tally up, send out gifts, run around. Maybe you want to feed our volunteers, all kinds of ways. So you can call 813-238-8001 if you can help out in one or more ways. And running down here, some other quick things. We've got The Humane Society and the Nature Coast and Labrador Retriever Rescue of Florida has their grand opening of their retail store and adoption center at Gulfview Square Mall. And that's in Port Richey. And that's this Saturday, October 1st, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. There'll be, the store features a wide range of specialty pet items and animal-related gift ideas. Dogs and cats will also be available for adoption. More information at humanerescue.org. Also, coming up the weekend after that, specifically Saturday, October 8th, at, Groovy Cats and Dogs in, Carrollwood, there will be the, Natural Pazopalooza. So that's Saturday, October 8th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. Information sessions, all kinds of, stuff being offered. You can meet people, find out more, eat. Go to groovycats.com to find out more about that. Skip that one. And also coming up, again, we talked about this, and we'll talk about it more specifically next week. But anyway, coming up is the second annual Tampa Bay Veg Fest, October 15th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at Okeechobee Fort Brook Park in downtown Tampa. And there's just all kinds of great stuff. Of course, there'll be vendors there and exhibitors. There'll be speakers, including Carol Leifer, the fabulous Carol Leifer. There'll be funs and games for kids. There'll be, I believe, a puppet show for kids. There'll be all kinds of other stuff. Great food, of course, and much, much more. You can find out more at TampaBayVegFest.org. And, and again, I'll get into this more at the end of the show, but we'll find out much more specifically all about VegFest next week. And, alright, well, if we have time, we'll come back to some more stuff later, but I think right now we need to step into the, Talking Animals Comedy Corner, which involves, animal-oriented comedy as always. This is Stephen Wright with a very brief snippet of a piece called Ants on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
I'm going to court next week. I've been selected for jury duty. It's kind of an insane case. 6,000 ants dressed up as rice and robbed a Chinese restaurant. I don't think they did it. I know a few of them and they wouldn't do anything like that.
All right. That was Stephen Wright with a snippet of a piece called Ants, taken from his album, I Have a Pony. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals. Our website is talkinganimals.net. It's another time to hear from today's guest, Jill Robinson. As I touched on earlier, Jill is the founder and executive director of the Animals Asia Foundation, a Hong Kong-based organization with offices worldwide devoted to the welfare of wild and urban animals in Asia. Since Jill created the organization in 1998, Animals Asia has pursued so-called flagship programs and campaigns, including its signature Moon Bear Rescue Campaign, which seeks to end bear farming and the bile trade. This conversation is anticipation of Jill giving a talk on Saturday, this Saturday, October 1st, at Loving Hut Restaurant right here in Tampa. And this conversation was recorded recently, so let's hear that conversation now with Jill Robinson on Talking Animals.
Joining us today on Talking Animals, Jill.
I'd love to speak with you, Duncan. Thank you.
Thank you. So given that that someone stepping into a foreign land, either literally or figuratively, and how that often profoundly changes them, is the stuff of great literature and often great animal organizations. I'd like to start with your own journey. Some 25 years ago, I know you've recounted this this tale many times, but I hope you wouldn't mind recounting it for us one more time, just because I think that'll provide important context for the other topics I hope to discuss with you.
Yeah, sure, Duncan. I arrived in Hong Kong, in 1985, and it really was the start of a very long journey. I think I had hopes of working in television, as I used to in the UK. But you know what? I very quickly found someone that worked for, at that time, the International Fund for Animal Welfare, and I'd always supported them back in the UK. And I started to work for him. His name was David Dawson, and I just began to work as a consultant for I4. And then David left Hong Kong, and I took over his role, and for the next 11 years, I was there in Hong Kong. doing a lot of undercover investigations, setting up various programs, and just really thoroughly enjoying being immersed in animal welfare in the Asia continent.
And so when you first moved, what I mean, were you sort of operating with minimal knowledge about kind of life with animals in Asia, or did you have at least a kind of a sense? I mean, what was it like in your very first years there?
No, I mean, goodness, it was a real culture shock, actually, because obviously as an animal lover from England, you know, when I got into Asia, I'd sort of walk out and see dogs and cats that had been abandoned in the streets. And, you know, there was a very big pet boom in Hong Kong, especially, where people really wanted to buy all these designer dogs that they saw, but then very quickly threw them away out on the streets. And there was a massive problem at that time. And, of course, even worse, just across the border in mainland China, where all these hideous live animal markets were existing, and they were being sold by the million as food for the table. So it was a very big sort of wake-up call for me personally, and you know, quite difficult really to interpret where we should be going in this.
Sure. So as you kind of were sort of having these kind of eye-opening experiences, that was also kind of when, or not long after that, when you were starting to kind of work with the International Fund for Animal Welfare in those initial years?
Yeah. I mean, with the dogs and cats, I had, I guess, what you'd call a eureka moment. And I was in my office, I'll never forget it, when I was just reading through literature about animal therapy in the UK. And there was a group called Pat Dogs, Pets as Therapy. And I just looked down at my old golden retriever as I was reading this literature, and I thought, goodness, Max, you can do this. And I just started to phone around hospitals and disabled centres and old people's homes to see if they would like to, begin an experiment, a pilot program, perhaps, for animal therapy. And I just got the phone slammed down at every opportunity by people that couldn't believe I was seriously suggesting bringing dirty, smelly, unhygienic mutts, as they thought, into a sterile hospital environment. And it was one matron of a children's hospital that finally said, I've heard about animal therapy. You have 1 hour in the garden with one dog. And that's pretty much how Dr. Dog, as I called it, started. And then I set up Animals Asia in Hong Kong, and we now operate across many countries. Dr. Dog works now out of 7 countries of Asia with 350 dogs. And, of course, as anyone knows with animal therapy, or anyone that's even got a dog, you know, at home, knows that they provide this amazing unconditional love that just reaches across so many barriers. And it's a phenomenally successful program of which I'm really proud.
For sure. Well, I can only take it that one hour, that sounds like you sort of were begrudgingly allowed to try this out and show people, went incredibly well, because obviously things have bloomed considerably since then.
It did. You know what, Duncan? It was actually a paraplegic boy that was wheeled out in his bed, and that's what started it. Max just went over to this boy's bed, and he could just move his arms, and Max just put his big golden paws on the boy's bed, and the kid's face just lit up like a Christmas tree.
Sure.
And I'll never forget, you know, the cameras were clicking, and the story was in the paper the next day, and we suddenly, you know, got deluged with people asking if they could have Dr. Dog visits with volunteers with their dogs who wanted to join the program. It's always about the individual, I find, and that one individual dog, Max, just started something, you know, very profound in Asia, and it works.
Well, and also sometimes it's the individual animal, but also sometimes it's the individual. I mean, it sounds like in almost 24 hours' time, you went from the kooky lady with this crazy idea about bringing a dog into a thing to, like, oh, my God, she's onto something fantastic, right? So those are always nice stories. But so this is Talking Animals in a recorded conversation. I'm talking with Jill Robinson, Animals Asia founder and CEO, who will be speaking in Tampa on October 1st at the Loving Hut, part of a dinner event that starts at 5:30 p.m. presented by Florida Voices for Animals. Hey, one other quick thing before we move on to some many other things I'd like to chat with you. But on the Dr. Dog front, I'm just curious if you've heard of a band called Dr. Dog. They hail from Philadelphia or thereabouts, and they've been around about 10 years and really a good sort of acclaimed band. And I just got to thinking as I was preparing for this interview, maybe there's some sort of teaming there, the band Dr. Dog with the program Dr. Dog.
Well, there you go, Duncan.
Yeah.
I'd love to speak with them if they'd like to speak with us. Goodness, that's a nice coincidence.
Sure. So in the early 90s, I guess not too long after you had launched the Dr. Dog program, I believe, you made your first visit to a bear farm, which seems to have kind of changed everything. I mean, for you and fortunately for a lot of bears. Maybe you could sort of recount that first visit and describe sort of the dreadful world of bear farms and the wonderful things you and Animals Asia have done to help these bears in the ensuing years.
Yeah, thank you, Duncan. Well, again, it was another one of these sort of amazing coincidences that I got a call from a journalist friend of mine one day who said he'd just been to one of these terrible bear farms in southern China. And at the time, there wasn't really much known about them at all. But I just, for some reason, felt compelled to go and have a look. I knew nothing about moon bears. I knew nothing about bear farming. But again, I felt that I should go along and check it out. And I joined a group of Japanese and Taiwanese tourists, went along, listened to the bear farmer and his wife talking about the virtues of bear farming and how brilliant bile was for the body, and you know, with some shock as they were trying to sort of sell everybody bear bile as well in the shop. And then I had been briefed by my friend where the actual bears were being extracted of their bile, and the tourists were not allowed to go into this particular area. You were encouraged to just go along and see the breeding bears only, but you weren't allowed to see the bears in the cages. So I found steps into a basement and found this horrible dark room with 32 bears in tiny crush cages, and just walked around this place in absolute abject horror. I've never seen anything so hideous in my life. And at one point, I must have backed too closely into a cage in shock, and a female moon bear touched my shoulder, and I turned around, and she had her paw still there, and it just seemed very natural to take it. Although today I would never do something as stupid. We know bears a little bit better today, and they can be very mischievous, they can be very unpredictable, and obviously very aggressive sometimes, but sure. Her paw was there, and for some reason that I'll never be able to explain, she just squeezed my fingers very rhythmically, and all I can say is that I just felt then a message went between us. I knew I'd never see her again, and I never did, but I gave her a name of Hong, which means bear in Chinese, and I walked out of that bear farming just knowing that everything had changed, and again, it was down to that one individual bear. She just started a whole new journey in my life, but more importantly, she started the dream of the China Bear Rescue, and I never forget that bear to this day.
Sure. And so that sort of powerful encounter with Hong did indeed launch, again, all kinds of things to make those bears' lives better. Maybe you could tell us about, you know, some of the programs and like the sanctuary and how those bears have been in large numbers now rescued from those bear farms. And also maybe we should talk a little bit more just for people listening who might not quite get the picture, like what those bear farms do and what the setup is and what the goal, the nefarious goal is of these bear farms.
Sure, thanks, Duncan. Well, bear farming is almost what I call a medieval practice. It's unbelievable in the physical and the psychological torture that the bears endure. There's about 10,000 bears in China, another 4,000 in Vietnam, and another couple of thousand in South Korea, Myanmar, and Laos. And they're caged for their entire lives in cages so small that they can hardly move. They are so physically tortured through either the bear farmers cutting their teeth back to gum level to take away their defenses and make them easier to milk. So these teeth are exposing the pulp and the nerves. They have their paw tips cut away so that the claws don't grow, and again to make them less dangerous. They have scars 3 to 4 feet along their bodies where they've literally grown into the cage bars. They're engaging in stereotypic behavior. So many of them are rubbing their heads against the bars of the cage. They wear down the tips of their ears, believe it or not, the fur on their face, the skin on their face, and one bear even rubbed away his nose cartilage. Mm-hmm. And worst of all, they have these awful problems within their abdomens as a result of being extracted for their bile from their gallbladders, which is used in traditional Asian medicine. The bile is extracted either through latex or metal catheters, literally surgically embedded into the gallbladders, or by the new method, which is actually allowed, believe it or not, under Chinese regulations, which is called the free drip method. And it's a fistula or a hole that is carved into the abdomen and gallbladder so that bile can freely drip out. They don't use catheters in this instance. They just literally cut a hole into the bear's gallbladder and abdomen. And this is something that the bear farmers have deceived the Chinese government to try to expand the notion that this is a humane method of bile extraction today. And obviously a 10-year-old child would understand that having a hole in our bodies is a perfect vector for bacterial infection. So since the early 90s, you know, myself and the team of Animals Asia have been investigating these awful bear farms. And we signed an agreement in 2000 with the Chinese government that we would work towards the end of bear farming in China. We built a sanctuary, which today has seen the rescue of 277 bears. And we have another sanctuary in Vietnam where the practice is now illegal. Our sanctuary there has rescued 88 bears. So altogether, we've rescued 365 bears. And, you know, our commitment to these animals is to keep them for the rest of their 30-year lifespan. It's an incredibly challenging program because, again, the condition that these bears arrive in, they're literally at death's door. And we have a promise to help them for the again for the next 30 years.
Wow. Well, boy, this you know, so many things to sound you know, dreadful about this. And one of the things too that again, if well, I mean, you're obviously a complete expert at this, but even if you just sort of look into this as kind of a layperson, the thing that you know, I guess is both surprising and maybe shouldn't be, is that this whole thing of getting the bile out of them through whatever means, you know, is really kind of folly to begin with. It seems like I mean, it seems like from what I gather, there's all kinds of things that could be done in lieu of bile, that you know, herbs and other things. That not only would serve the same purpose, but I also further gather that there's almost sort of a contradiction here medically, where you know, the people that are often given this bile then develop, you know, liver, kidney disease, other difficulties. So, you know, whatever the alleged medical benefits of this are actually working against many people who receive this.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Duncan. As we always say, no one is going to die for the lack of bear bile. You know, I think we cannot be under any misapprehension. Bear bile does work. It's not just analyzed within traditional Chinese medicine pharmacopoeia as a cold medicine to treat heat-related illnesses like high fevers and high temperatures and chronic liver complaints. But it's also been analyzed, for example, by experts at the Minnesota University who say that potentially bear bile can rejuvenate cells in your brain that would otherwise die. So it's potentially a cure for Huntington's, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's. But it's also being synthesized by the ton across the world, not from bears at all, but from slaughterhouse byproducts, where it is used for, again, chronic liver complaints, for breaking down gallstones, and a host of other areas where bear bile is absolutely not needed. And as you said very correctly, what is now being found is that, you know, bear bile from these horribly diseased animals on the farms is contaminated. I mean, our bears are dying of liver cancer when they eventually lose their lives in numbers too high to be coincidence. About 35% of our bears are now dying of liver tumors. And honestly, when you see one of those livers, let alone, you know, 35% of them, it's just awful. And the bile juice itself, as a result, is contaminated with bacteria and cancer cells, and we're also seeing blood and urine and feces and mm-hmm. rust flakes. Again, a whole host of problems, which when taken by consumers is now said by doctors in Vietnam to be killing those same consumers. So there's a big red alert about this practice of bear farming, which shows that it's not just significantly endangering the health of the bears and indeed killing them, but it's now endangering the health and indeed killing humans who take the contaminated bile.
And so with that in mind, Jill, and along with the agreement that that was struck back in 2000, I mean, is there a timetable or a series of timetables that are part of that agreement that especially in light of now these medical discoveries about just the horrible downsides of bear bile, is there you know, sort of a cutoff point or something that people could sort of feel like, okay, by such and such a time we will actually end and outlaw fully bear farming?
I wish there was. No, there's not. It's an open-ended agreement, and of course we're really trying to escalate the ending bear farming program, particularly in China, as rapidly as we can.
Sure.
There's many, many different components to this campaign, Duncan, and we're working very intensively with traditional Chinese medicine doctors, associations not just only in China, but internationally too. And here in the USA, we're very, very proud to be working with the American College of Traditional Chinese Medicine, with whom I'm actually just flying out later today to join in London later this week, where we're holding a panel within a conference of 600 to 800 Chinese medicine doctors from all over the world who are flying in, and the panel is about the use of endangered species and how and why we must replace them within Chinese medicine pharmacopoeia. We're also actually having a reception at the House of Commons together as well with members of the European Parliament and members of Parliament in the UK. So there's, you know, this is just from the Chinese medicine perspective, but obviously in China itself we're working with the government. We have an agreement now where we came out and encouraged, persuaded 20 provinces across the country to be bear farm free. So that's over two-thirds of the country now has promised to be bear farm free. We're working with major celebrities across the country. There's one very famous singer and actress who's called the Madonna of Asia. She's that popular. And she has been helping us massively now for the last few years across the country. The media, of course, they're a very, very big push for our end-to-bear farming. And
sure,
we conduct media salons and conferences with heads of the biggest media outlets in the country to get the word out. And again, you know, this is a very key issue in our public education programs too, where we have summer camps on site at our sanctuary. We do lots and lots of presentations to universities, business groups, academics across the country. Again, just keep getting the word out there. And,
sure,
and people, you know, in China, one of my biggest bugbears is when I do interviews, you know, either with media or I do presentations in different countries, is hearing time and time again from people, oh, the Chinese don't care about animals. And, you know, if one thing we can walk off this interview absolutely comprehending is that people in China care every bit as much about animal welfare as we do in the West. When I began, there was one animal welfare group, and now there are 70 across the country with whom we work to make a difference for animals, whether it's dogs and cats or bears or zoos or any other animal welfare issue. People in China are engaged, passionate, and connected with ending all the abuses that we currently see for animals there in the country. So it's a very, very exciting time to be living and working in China.
Absolutely. Well, and also even before you got into sort of the last statement about the huge leap in number of groups working on animal welfare, just prior to that, and certainly with your forthcoming meeting, et cetera, it sounds like there's reasons for great optimism, and you sound very, very hopeful about just this particular period being bringing great change in this way.
Very much. Yeah, it's a time of great shift, and people really, and you know, I used to, there's two examples. I used to say, you know, that it was just so difficult to work through these problems, you know, and every time a new issue came up, I'd think, oh my goodness, what on earth can we do? Now I don't have to think like that anymore, because as soon as something, you know, occurs, an example of cruelty, you will generally get the various animal welfare groups in that region just pounding in there and taking up the mantle for themselves. There's just no need for us to do so much as we used to do anymore. And no way was this greater emphasized by a few weeks ago when there were public demonstrations about a bear farmer that was trying to go public, believe it or not, on the stock exchange. And all across the country, there was just this amazing outcry of disgust that someone had the temerity to do this. And someone in Shanghai called me and just simply said, Jill, you can step back a little. This is our fight now. And, you know, this was from a Chinese person. And you know, wow. This, I think, just encapsulates the passion, the dedication, and the aggression almost for ending animal welfare abuses in China.
Yeah, well, that does seem to be just a moment that really captures tremendous progress, and that's really great because, you know, one of the things I was going to sort of raise with you, but you've already addressed it sort of preemptively and also indicated how wrong I had it, it would seem that before you said this, that sometimes just the work would be, work in Asia would be so sprawling and therefore so daunting on just, you know, with just the geography, much less all the issues. But in fact, it sounds like over time, since you've been there with all these other groups springing up and awareness rising or whatever, that the reverse is true, that things have gotten better. I wouldn't say great, but I mean, certainly easier. And it sounds like you have a lot of support and help from all kinds of groups and individuals.
Absolutely. People are just not tolerating cruelty anymore. And, you know, they're even just going out there and locking themselves in cages, pedestals, you know, and demonstrating in the streets. My goodness, you couldn't have demonstrated in the streets just a few years ago. Of course not. We actually burned bile in the street, bear bile, which we got from 33 Chinese medicine pharmacies. They allowed us to take all the stock off their shelves and burn it in the streets. Goodness, what else? I mean, demonstrations everywhere. It's absolutely phenomenal to see and pretty remarkable too. You know, these are kids that are going into warehouses and liberating cats and dogs that are destined for the meat markets across China. They're stopping trucks that are transporting these dogs, you know, from one end of the country to the other, which will, you know, eventually end up on people's plates. And they're discovering the drivers don't have licenses, and they're persuading the authorities to confiscate the licenses and then putting those same dogs into animal welfare sanctuaries and getting them out there adopted into the community. It's just amazing to see the shift in attitude and the absolute difference now that people are making for animals across the country.
So encouraging. Wow, that's really terrific. Well, again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Stress. My guest is Jill Robinson, Animal Asia founder and CEO, who will be speaking in Tampa on October 1st at the Loving Hut, part of a dinner event organized by Florida Voices for Animals. This is a recorded conversation. So Jill, gosh, it sounds like you say, it's a big shift, and it sounds like it's at the fundamental cultural level that this shift is taking place.
Yes, I mean, absolutely. You know, there's obviously culture does change, you know, over time to address various issues. Otherwise, you know, foot binding and slavery would still be out there. And you know, the universities and the colleges in China are springing up with green groups across the country. You know, the internet, people are very, very aware with what is happening now.
Yeah.
You know, and even sort of, I don't know if you remember when the melamine scandal hit China and melamine was mm-hmm. found in the milk and children were dying from taking this milk. And, you know, again, the Chinese public just rose up against this, absolutely outraged this was allowed to happen. And, you know, it's not just like animal welfare, it's all across the board, you know, where any injustice is addressed and reversed. It's quite, you know, remarkable.
Sure. Well, so I'd be curious, Jill, then, that with all this progress and sort of, you know, just a sea change culturally and otherwise, you know, what's the biggest challenge or hurdle now for the work that Animals Asia and again, all these other groups that have popped up in the wake of yours? What's the toughest thing, you know, now with all the advances that you have made?
Well, in terms of Animals Asia, our biggest challenge is really sort of battling against the deceit of the bear farmers. You know, they are, you know, a very sort of sly and consolidated group that come out with the most amazing statements that we're using old footage. that we're using sort of old professors, doctors that don't know what they're talking about. You know, that things have changed drastically within the fair farming industry. Things are humane now. You know, and it's our challenge is to sort of keep rescuing the bears, to show up to the minute pathology of these horribly diseased animals and how badly they're suffering, again, both physically and psychologically, and to really stay connected, obviously, with the government and show them the results of our research, show them the bears that are coming in from the farms, and keep pushing on our public education programs across the country to engage the public at different levels, whether it's the man and the woman in the street, whether it's the university students, the doctors, the academics, the lawyers, the celebrities, the media, etc., just to keep the truth out there in the public eye and make sure that these bear farmers can never, you know, rise up strongly to actually continue sanctioning bear farming.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just so interesting too, as you're talking more, it just makes me think that, you know, one of the sort of missions of this show is to examine issues, sometimes specific to a certain country or region and therefore find the universal aspects and learn how those folks in those countries are contending or responding. So, you know, that many more of us can be better equipped, more effective, better educated. For example, I mean, we've chatted a couple times with Brian May of Queen, who, beyond being a fabulous rock star, he holds a PhD in astrophysics, very smart and articulate, and very vocal about halting this proposed badger call in the UK. Well, that's very specific to the UK. Bear farming is very specific to where you are. And yet, a lot of the fundamental issues in Canada campaigns, and of course what the other side does to discredit the, you know, whether it's the science or, hey, this is old footage. I mean, there's, you know, unfortunately, but also it's helpful. It's very universal, because then you can really everybody can start to learn from all these different things, even if they are very specific to that region or that country, about how to sort of respond and mount a more effective campaign.
Yeah, I mean, you're absolutely right, Duncan. And again, it's communication is the key. And one of the biggest factors in our funding is to provide the resources for, you know, people in China to really be, you know, compliant with the problem. So we have a lot of conferences, for example, across the country that we raise funds for people to get into one room to talk about the problems that the animals face and the solutions that we can work on together to help them. It's a big component of what we do, and even sending, you know, some of them to other countries as well, you know, obviously to come over here to the USA, to come to some of the big conferences here.
Sure.
So, you know, it just linking people up with other like-minded people, perhaps even people that will potentially fund them. You know, there's a lot of sanctuaries, for example, that are set up in China to help these dogs and cats, for example, as well as our bears. And, you know, it's trying to sort of source the funding to help people like ourselves in the country. So it's a long journey, but I think, you know, we're very inspired by the passion and, again, the inspiration by these local groups in China who just didn't exist before. And now I think, are never going to let this go. They're in it for life.
Sure. Well, as you say, it's a long journey, but especially from your perspective, look how far you've come. I mean, geez, it's gigantic, right? Yeah. So, we're just sort of nearing the end of our time, Jill, but we obviously talked about bears and cats and dogs. I mean, can we just speak briefly, at least in our remaining time, maybe about tigers for a moment?
Well, it's not sort of one of the core campaigns that we do, and there's a million other groups in the US that are dealing, and in China, of course, that are dealing with the tiger issue. But, of course, you know, it's a fundamentally worrying problem, because, you know, I went to a tiger farm many, many years ago, and, you know, it seems, again, that these farmers are just biding their time until they can be sanctioned to sell tiger bone and other tiger parts legally out there in the trade. And, you know, if they do, obviously it's just going to hype up the demand, as it is with the bears. You know, people, in terms of the bear farming industry, people that go onto these farms and buy the bile, if they've got more money in their pockets, they simply want the real thing in the form of whole gallbladders. from wild caught bears, and I think it's exactly the same as the tiger industry. It's much, much cheaper to go out there into the wild and take a tiger for free, for nothing, and then sell the parts during the trade, and it's the same for the bears as well. So who in their right mind would ever sanction a tiger farm when, you know, realistically, you can never tell the difference when you buy those parts of the tigers, whether they've come from a farm or from whether they've come from the wild. And of course, ultimately in animal welfare, these farms are hideous. They are fundamentally cruel. They're abusive. The tigers are not being raised properly. They're inbred. They come out with all sorts of problems that I've seen personally. And again, it's another issue that I really hope, you know, is taken seriously, not just by the authorities in China, but obviously by people like CITES, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. We need to look very, very seriously at this problem.
Sure.
And end the farming of these species. It is not helping their population in the wild. And I should just clarify that as well. You know, we've got people like the Smithsonian and the IUCN Bear Specialist Group here in the USA that categorically say that farming bears does not assist their population in the wild. And
sure.
I can only assume that would be the same for the tigers.
Right. Well, and again, that back to sort of how universal some of these issues are fundamentally, even if they're very specific to a certain country or region. I mean, you hear that kind of spiel wherever you are about, hey, we are helping, this is a conservation effort, and you know, I mean, it's complete baloney. I mean,
yeah.
In almost every instance, it has nothing to do with that. But again, you get a lot of people sort of temporarily at least buying that line, and so it takes a little bit longer to make the inroads. But boy, it sure seems like Animals Asia has made tremendous inroads. And again, as you say, over the years with more and more help from more and more groups that have popped up. So Jill, I think we are just sort of now at the end of our time. But gosh, I really, really appreciate the time, and I feel like I've learned a lot, and perhaps our listeners are going to feel the same way. And I really just thank you for all your great work over the years, and we'll look forward to seeing you in Tampa on October 1st.
I can't wait. Very much looking forward to meeting everyone, and thank you for the opportunity, Duncan, too.
Thank you again, Jill. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right. Jill Robinson. And again, she will be speaking in town this Saturday at the Loving Hut. And as part of that, there'll be a nice vegan buffet, et cetera. So you do need to RSVP if you'd like to come out and hear Jill in person. So you can call Loving Hut at 813-977-7888. I'm Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time now to proceed to name that animal tune. There'll be a prize, a copy of the new 2-CD package by singer-songwriter Richard X. Heyman, also a pretty legendary New York City cat rescuer. To the first person who calls in 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal tune, chosen to salute a veteran band that called it quits last week. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals, and then we'll be right back with Sharon Dipple from Greyhound Support Transport. It's WMNF. We'll take one quick call, and we got to get to Sharon. But let's see if. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Hello.
Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
It's R.E.M.
Right, that's the band.
I don't know the name of the song,
though. Oh well, the whole name of the contest is name that animal tune. So, all right, well, you're partway there. All right, thanks for calling. Okay, folks. Well, keep trying. Maybe we'll take them off the air as time permits. But now we want to introduce Sharon Dipple from Greyhound Support Transport. And Sharon, are you there? Good morning.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really well, and thanks so much for joining us on Talking Animals. Let's jump right into it. What is Greyhound Support Transport?
Greyhound Support Transport was founded in 2008. It was founded by Monica Smith-Rigo, and she has been in the greyhound industry as a trainer for 27 plus years. What Monica found was the need to move greyhound dogs out of the state of Florida to find them homes in non-racing states. Reason behind this is there's currently 11 tracks that are racing in the state, and these tracks hold, on the average, between 800 and 1,000 dogs. One in four greyhounds never even qualifies to race. So we have a large percentage of dogs in the state that need homes. So what Monica thought was, you know, why not take these dogs and haul them to non-racing states in the U.S. and Canada? So that's basically what Greyhound Support Transport does. We also have put together a fund for dogs that break their legs on the racetracks. We take these dogs in and we repair their legs. Then we put them into fostering, and once their legs are repaired, we either give them to groups within the area that we work with, one being Bay Area Greyhounds, or we haul them outside of the state to find homes. And when I say we haul these dogs outside of the state, Duncan, we work with adoption groups that specialize in the greyhound dogs all over the United States.
Okay, well, this sounds really good, and you've raised some really interesting, I think, hopefully follow-up questions. Starting with, at those tracks where there's all those dogs and only one in four qualify, do you make an arrangement with them so that they're willing to just hand over X amount of dogs to be transported to those non-racing states, or how does that work?
Well, there are adoption groups all over the state of Florida that work with the individual tracks. There's also groups that are on the tracks themselves that are adoption groups. Greyhound Support Transport is not an adoption group. We are a transport group.
Right.
So we take the excess dogs that the adoption groups in the area cannot handle, and that's where we move them.
Oh, okay. So the transport, sorry, I guess I might have gotten the chronology wrong, but from your explanation. So they're already kind of sprung, as it were, from the track, those excess dogs, by the time that Greyhound Support Transport comes into the picture.
Well, we work specifically with the Flagler track. We work with Bonita. We work with the St. Pete track. And we actually work out of state with Mobile in Alabama. And those are the tracks that we work with. And within those tracks, there are kennels. And once these dogs are graded off of the kennels, they try to move them either through the adoption groups, or if there are no adoption groups that are have space available, they contact us and they say, hey, Monica, we have, you know, two dogs in Miami that need to be transported. Or, you know, St. Pete, the kennel's there, will contact us and say, you know, there's X amount that need. And they actually will hold these dogs until we can put a haul together.
Okay. And, all right, so, and when you say the non-racing states, is that, I mean, are there ones in particular that seem to be frequently where those dogs are relocated, or is it pretty much wide open that where they might land as long as they're non-racing states?
Well, we have partners throughout the United States that we work with. And when we call non-racing states, those would be states that normally don't have greyhound tracks, mm-hmm. but they have people and families that are interested in the breed. So we work with groups in Oregon. We work with groups in Seattle. We work with groups in Canada. I mean, all over where we have specific areas, Colorado, Texas. I mean, you know, we have multiple adoption groups that we will bring these dogs to.
And let me ask, just for the purposes of kind of having a little bit of a, you know, underlying context for all this, let me ask the dopey, but hopefully dopey on purpose question. Why don't we want dogs racing, and what are some of the pitfalls for those dogs who are involved in racing?
Well, number one, I want you to understand we are a pro racing group. We work directly with the tracks. There's a lot of misconception out there as how these dogs are treated. We are going to have a picnic on 10-2, and it's in Eagle Lake Park. At this picnic, you're going to see all aspects of the greyhound industry within the racing community come together to help fund Greyhound Support Transport. This shows you the love of the industry for the dog. You're going to see at this picnic from Derby Lane, Alderson, Abernathy, Capable, Cal Holland, Campbell. There's Victoria Hounds. This is a group of people that own the Greyhounds that will be there. They'll be wearing their shirts and showing support. You're going to see farms there that breed the dogs, Onico, Suncoast, Royal. You're going to see adoption groups. We have a sister group, Bay Area Greyhound Adoptions. They'll be there in force. The public needs to realize that the dogs are not mistreated. There's, like I said, a lot of misconception. They're just not pets, and there's a difference.
And I think a lot of people might be surprised to hear that there's that level of cooperation, because you sometimes, you know, do hear the racing, you know, side of things, you know, portrayed as darker, more villainous than what you've indicated here.
What, Duncan? News is never good.
What's never good?
When you look at the news, they don't give you feel-good stories most of the time. Any news.
Okay.
They try to tell you all the bad stuff and the negativism. And you see a lot of that within the Greyhound industry, because people take sides and, you know, they want to show, how can I say this? There's an awful lot of people out there that have this misconception, and it's usually given to the public based upon groups that would like to stop the racing.
Right.
But they're really not in the know. There's a lot of knowledge that is not positively put, and that's why this picnic is so important. Because it will give a positive publicity to everything.
And more than just positive publicity, it sounds like you're saying that there's a huge educational component that's going to be extremely important about the picnic.
Oh, definitely. And why all these groups are getting together to assist Greyhound Support, this is something that probably the public doesn't know, but the National Greyhound Association, the NGA, requires a pet fee from every owner when they register their dog. And it's for $85. And once that dog retires, that money goes toward the placement of the dog into the adoption community to help offset the costs.
That sounds like a very, very sound practice. And Sharon, we're probably just nearing the end of our time, so let me just hit a couple of points, or you can as well, mm-hmm. about the picnic. We've alluded to the picnic again. It's this Sunday, October 2nd. It's at Eagle Lake Park
mm-hmm.
in Largo. It's 11 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all kinds of eats and silent auction and raffle and all these groups and opportunities to find out a lot more about the Greyhound world. And I know initially I think you guys were hoping for an RSVP just for a head count to make sure you had enough food by a couple of days ago. But I assume that people listening now who might want to still go, you're still open to have other people still attend. Right?
Oh, definitely. Actually, Duncan, I'm the one who's cooking.
Oh, okay. All right. So you're just going to keep going.
We've currently got about 100 on the RSVP. I welcome the public to attend. They can send me an email at sbdipple@earthlink.net and just give me a heads up if there's going to be 2, 4, 6, how many would like to attend. We're going to have some great silent auction items. The community has put in and supported us, the Melting Pot, Publix, Busch Gardens, Winn-Dixie, I could keep going.
Wow.
Outback, Bonefish. I mean, all of these people have given gift certificates for us to, you know, silent auction off. We've got collars and feeders, and I mean,
Sounds like it's a grand extravaganza, Sharon. So, all right. So, again, let's just repeat your email there one more time. It's sbdipple at earthlink.net for anyone who wants to find out more information or join you on Sunday. Again, that's this Sunday, October 2nd, Eagle Lake Park in Largo for Greyhound Support Transport. Sharon, thank you so much for joining us today on Talking Animals, and good luck Sunday.
I appreciate it, and we appreciate your support, Duncan.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, October 5th at 11 a.m. when our guest will be Isabel Tosi, chief organizer of the second annual Tampa Bay Veg Fest, a wonderful multifaceted event taking place October 15th that we wanted to be sure to spotlight before we got busy with the WMNF Fall Fun Drive that starts again 2 weeks from today, October 12th. So Isabel will be joining us next Wednesday, October 5th. I hope you'll join us as well. I also hope you'll visit our website, talkinganimals.net, where we make available all sorts of information, as well as archives and podcasts of past Talking Animals shows. We also have a link to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. That's all found at talkinganimals.net. Talking Animals broadcast outreach consultant is Libby McKenna. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. Stay tuned for the fabulous Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music, airing next from noon to 3. And, all right, well, we only have a few seconds, but we were going to close out. We still will, I guess, today's show with an animal tune. This is The Dead Weather with I Cut Like a Buffalo, taking us up to the NPR News. And then Scott Elliott and his great, great show right here on WMNF Tampa. See you next Wednesday, 11 a.m., Talking Animals.